may never see again. You have just one empty seat in your car. Who do you pick up? Well, you certainly owe a debt of gratitude to your childhood friend. But you should also pick up the stranger and save his life. And what of romance? As I say, you may never see the person of your dreams again. What do you do? There's a very nice solution. But you have to stop thinking as if you have to pick up just one person. You have to stop thinking as if you have to be behind the wheel. Hand the car keys to your friend and ask him to drive the heart attack victim to the nearest hospital. Then wrap your coat around the person of your dreams. That's creative thinking. In the next lecture, we'll return to the flow of argument, but take it far beyond the logic of Aristotle. In our last lecture, we used Aristotle's syllogisms to emphasize the central concept of validity. We need to know when the logic of an argument is solid, a genuinely logical transition from premises to conclusion. Visualizing syllogisms in terms of three-circle Venn diagrams gave us a picture of validity in the strongest Aristotelian sense, airtight, ironclad validity. Now it's time to go beyond Aristotle. His is a wonderful little logic, but it's a little logic. The structure of human reasoning goes much farther. Structure is the key to logic, just as Aristotle said. But we need to look at the structure of argument much more broadly than he did. We also need to look at validity much more broadly. We emphasize that Aristotle's validity is validity in the highest degree. It's what we now call deductive validity. Given the truth of the premises, an argument is deductively valid if the conclusion absolutely has to be true. Given the truth of the premises, it's impossible for the conclusion to be false. Ironclad, airtight validity is great when you can get it. But it's actually pretty rare outside of the realm of pure mathematics or perfect little syllogisms. If we restricted our reasoning to cases in which arguments had to be absolutely ironclad, our reasoning wouldn't get us very far. The full concept of validity is wider than that. In general, validity refers to the degree of support between premises and conclusion. All kinds of support, of all different degrees. Does this fact support this claim? Do these premises render the conclusion highly plausible? Does this evidence give us good reason to believe the conclusion? The reasoning may not be airtight, but is it solid enough to act upon? Here, we'll emphasize validity in this wider sense, as a matter of logical support between premises and conclusion, even if not ironclad. Here's an example of the kind of argument we have to deal with every day. You'll notice that it's far more complicated than a syllogism. Spending $50 billion in annual economic aid to foreign countries would be justified only if we knew that either they would genuinely benefit from the exchange or that we would. We don't know that we would benefit from the exchange. It might further weaken our already vulnerable economy. We don't know that they would genuinely benefit. The track record of foreign aid that's been misdirected, misappropriated, or lost in foreign corruption is all too familiar. With $50 billion a year, we could offer college scholarships to every high school graduate and major health benefits for every man, woman, and child in the United States. Our obligations are first and foremost to our fellow citizens. We should spend that $50 billion here rather than in foreign aid. There are lots of premises in that argument, far more than in Aristotle's syllogisms, lots of transition steps. Together, they're intended to drive us toward the conclusion. But how good is the argument? And how should we analyze an argument like that? Trying to decompose it into syllogism seems a little crazy. Is there some other tool we can use to analyze more complex arguments? Yes, a very simple visualization. It doesn't give us an automatic answer like Venn diagrams did. We've left the comfy realm of automatic answers behind. But engaging the validity of an argument, we still have to look systematically at logical flow. And a great tool for that is a flow diagram. The idea is to use a flow diagram to sketch the train of thought. That'll let us see how the premises are intended to support the conclusion. We can then look at how strong those lines of support really are. A flow graph of the argument will help us see how valid it is. As in the case of syllogisms, of course, even a solidly valid argument isn't enough to guarantee truth. Validity doesn't address the truth of the premises, for example. But it can tell us whether the truth of those premises would be enough to assure us of the conclusion, or whether we wouldn't be justified in believing the conclusion even if the premises were true. Breaks, disconnects, and weak logical links can show us invalidity in an argument. So, how to analyze complex arguments? Let's give flow diagrams a try. The basic rule is simple. When one claim is intended to support another, we put an arrow from the first to the second. That sounds pretty simple, but it can be tricky. Here's one problem. Let me give you a proposition. You tell me whether we should enter it as a premise or a conclusion. Gladys's marriage is on the rocks. Is that a premise or a conclusion? The answer is that it might be either. In one context, it might appear as a premise. In another context, it might appear as a conclusion. It all depends on the context of argument. Here, for example, it appears in the conclusion. Gladys is no longer interested in Bill. Bill seems to find no time for Gladys. Gladys's marriage is on the rocks. But the same proposition might appear as a premise in a different argument, like this one. Gladys's marriage is on the rocks. Her sister Ethel has mounting gambling debts. Their mother is in the hospital. The whole family is having trouble. There, Gladys's marriage comes in as just one premise toward a different conclusion, that the whole family is having trouble. Propositions don't come labeled as premises or conclusions. They can function in either role. It all depends on the context, on the structure of the argument. Here's another difficulty. The first sentence you hear doesn't always come first logically. Consider this little argument, for example. If the governor is impeached, we might be no better off. Impeaching him would require another election. But there's always the chance that people would then vote for someone equally corrupt. We could number the propositions in the order of presentation. But what we want to know is something different. We want to know where the reasoning flows from and where it flows to. It'll help if we can identify the conclusion. Which is the conclusion, the first, second, or third sentence? One, if the governor is impeached, we might be no better off. Two, impeachment would require another election. Three, we would therefore have the possibility that people would vote for someone equally corrupt. It's the first, proposition one, that's the conclusion, right there at the beginning. Everything else is offered in support of that conclusion. The logic of the argument starts from two, impeachment would require another election. That leads to three, we would therefore have the possibility that people would vote for someone equally corrupt. And that leads to the conclusion. If the governor is impeached, we might be no better off. Draw it in a flow diagram, and you have an arrow from two to three, and another from there to one. Arrows for logical flow. Simple argument, simple flow diagram. Of course, arguments get more complicated than that. We'll need to add complications in the flow diagrams. First of all, arrows can branch. A set of propositions can lead to multiple conclusions, parallel conclusions. Listen to this argument and think about how you'd graph it. We can only get so much money from taxes. Taxation resources have to be balanced across different social needs. Taxation for prisons must therefore be balanced against taxation for education. If we build more prisons, we'll have less for education. If we spend more on education, we'll have less for the prisons we may need. Number those 1 through 4, and figure out what the argument flow diagram will look like. Press pause if you want, and then come back. That argument has branching conclusions. The first proposition leads directly to the second. From 1, we can only get so much money from taxes, taxation resources have to be balanced across different social needs. We graph an arrow to 2. Taxation for prisons must therefore be balanced against taxation for education. But at that point, our arrows branch. If taxation for prisons must be balanced against taxation for education, it follows that 3, if we build more prisons, we'll have less for education. If taxation for each has to be balanced against the other, it also follows that 4, if we spend more on education, we'll have less for the prisons we may need. Notice that I haven't said anything about the truth of those premises. Here, as in Aristotle, we're just examining the flow of the argument. We want to trace the intended train of thought, a logical line that is supposed to step us from one proposition to another to the conclusion, or as in this case, to multiple conclusions. Here's a second complication in argument flow diagrams. Just as arrows can branch out, they can branch in. Sometimes several propositions lead to the same place. We'll start with a simple case, in which there are a set of different premises that lead independently to the same conclusion. Independent reasons are reasons that don't need each other. They are each little arguments in their own right. So here's an example. We are dangerously reliant on foreign energy sources. Our oil comes primarily from the Middle East. Most of our natural gas does as well. Even the elements in our batteries come from places like Zambia, Nairobi, and China. In order to analyze the argument, start by numbering the propositions. Then draw a flow diagram of how the logic is supposed to go. First, find the conclusion. It's not the last sentence. This isn't an argument about batteries. It's an argument for a general conclusion about our reliance on foreign energy sources. The conclusion is the first sentence. Each of the other propositions is a little argument for that conclusion in its own right. In an advertising layout, this is called bullet type. You're given 3 independent reasons to buy a Hyundai, for example. It gets good gas mileage. It looks great. It comes with an extended warranty. All independent reasons. The reasons in this argument work the same way. Our oil comes primarily from the Middle East. Conclusion? We are dangerously reliant on foreign energy sources. Our natural gas does too. Conclusion? We are dangerously reliant on foreign energy sources. Even the elements in our batteries come from places like Zambia, Nairobi, and China. Conclusion? We are dangerously reliant on foreign energy sources. 3 independent lines of support. We graph it by having little arrows converge on a single conclusion. Independent reasons function independently. But sometimes reasons have to function together in order to lead to a conclusion. Dependent reasons only function together. Here's what an argument based on dependent reasons looks like. If both partners are indifferent, any marriage is guaranteed to fail. Gladys no longer cares about the relationship. Her husband Bill is far too busy with work to think about his relationship with Gladys. This marriage is doomed. The context indicates that Gladys and Bill are married. We can number the first proposition 1. If both partners are indifferent, any marriage is guaranteed to fail. Note that it says both partners. Along with 1, we therefore need both 2, that Gladys is indifferent, and 3, that Bill is indifferent, in order to get our conclusion. Here, all 3 propositions work together. Those are dependent reasons. In order to mark them as a set that has to work together, I graph them with a plus between them, a bar under all 3, and a single arrow from there to the conclusion. So how do you know whether propositions are working independently toward a conclusion or working dependently? Argument stress testing. Stress testing in a machine or an organization involves asking what'll happen if a certain component fails. We do the same thing here. If you have independent reasons and one of them fails, the argument should still go through. Let's stress test our example about energy reliance. 1. We are dangerously reliant on foreign energy sources. 2. Our oil comes primarily from the Middle East. 3. Most of our natural gas does as well. 4. Even the elements in our batteries come from places like Zambia, Nairobi, and China. Put it through a stress test. The conclusion is 1. 2, 3, and 4 are given in support. But what if 3 turns out to be false? Excuse me, Mr. Speaker, but the fact is that most of our natural gas does not come from the Middle East. Is Mr. Speaker lunched? Is the argument over? No. He may be a bit embarrassed, but the argument is still standing. All right. But be that as it may, it is still true that we are dangerously reliant on foreign energy. Our oil comes primarily from the Middle East. We use batteries for energy, but even the elements in our batteries come from places like Zambia, Nairobi, and China. You can test each of the other premises the same way. If you knock out a reason and the argument is still standing, it must be because that was an independent reason. That won't hold for dependent reasons. Consider the second example. If both partners are indifferent, any marriage is guaranteed to fail. Gladys no longer cares about the relationship. Her husband Bill is far too busy with work to think about his relationship with Gladys. This marriage is doomed. Excuse me, Mr. Speaker, but you're wrong about Gladys. She still cares deeply about the relationship. Unless he changes one of the other claims, the argument is now dead in the water. The basic premise was that if both partners are indifferent, a marriage is guaranteed to fail. His conclusion was that this marriage is therefore doomed. But if he's wrong about Gladys, the other parts aren't enough to give him that conclusion. That's the sign of propositions functioning dependently. You now have the basic elements of any argument flow graph. But when you start to graph real arguments, you see how those elements can combine into an immense variety of structures. Take the argument we started with, for example. We'll number the propositions in order. 1. Spending $50 billion in annual economic aid to foreign countries would be justified only if we knew that either they would genuinely benefit from the exchange or that we would. 2. We don't know that we would benefit from the exchange. 3. It might further weaken our already vulnerable economy. 4. We don't know that they would genuinely benefit. 5. We're all too familiar with the fact that our foreign aid has very often been misdirected, misappropriated, or lost in foreign corruption. 6. With $50 billion a year, we could offer college scholarships to every high school graduate and major health benefits for every man, woman, and child in the United States. 7. Our obligations are first and foremost to our fellow citizens. 8. We should spend that $50 billion here rather than in foreign aid. The conclusion is 8. How are the rest of the propositions meant to support that conclusion? Press pause and make a graph of how you think this argument is supposed to flow. Take a few minutes. This is a pretty complicated argument. Then come back. Here's my sketch of that argument. The argument uses two dependent clusters functioning independently of each other. One cluster uses 1, 2, and 4. Spending $50 billion in economic aid to foreign countries would be justified only if we knew either A or B. We don't know A. We don't know B. So spending the money that way isn't justified. Those work together. That's why I represent them with a plus between them and a bar beneath them. Together, they offer a little independent argument. If a stress test showed that the stuff about the college education in 6 and 7 was false, 1, 2, and 4 together would still stand as an independent argument for the conclusion. Where do 3 and 5 appear in that argument? They're really little backups for 2 and 4. 2 says we don't know that we would benefit from the exchange. Why? Because 3, it might further weaken our economy. 4 says that we don't know that they would benefit. Why? Because 5, foreign aid has so often gone astray. All of those together make one argument for the conclusion. There's another argument in there that comes from 6 and 7 working together. With that money, we could offer college scholarships to every high school graduate and major health benefits for every man, woman, and child in the United States. And our obligations are first and foremost to our fellow citizens. Those together offer their own little argument for spending the money here rather than in foreign aid. As real arguments go, even that one is fairly simple. Here's the real challenge. Clip out a newspaper editorial. Take just one or two paragraphs and graph out the argument. If you do that, you'll discover a number of things. Just as we said, the conclusion doesn't always come last. Sometimes it takes real work to figure out what the conclusion is supposed to be. You'll also find that the flow of reasons can be very complex. Often two claims support a third, which is a subconclusion. It's like a subtotal. It's an intermediate conclusion, just part of the way toward a final conclusion. You'll find some claims in an editorial that are very important. Some will be minor. Some will be widely accepted. Some will be accepted only in very specific belief structures. The most important thing you'll notice is how much goes unsaid in normal arguments. What goes unsaid is often the most important part. An argument is often most vulnerable at the points at which major assumptions are made, but are not made explicit. With an understanding of the flow of argument, we have the tools for looking at validity and vulnerability, argumentative strengths and weaknesses. How valid is the argument? That means, how strong is the logical flow from premises to conclusion? If the premises are true, is the conclusion extremely plausible, highly probable, downright inescapable? If the answer to any of these is yes, we have a valid argument. This is still an internal evaluation of logical strength. It doesn't tell us whether the premises are in fact true. If they are true, we have something even better, a sound argument. A sound argument is one that's both valid and does have true premises. Because they're true and because the reasoning is valid, we have solid reasons to believe the conclusion is true, too. I'm going to expand a little on flow graphs for arguments using the work of the philosopher Stephen Tolman. We've talked about premises that function together, representing them as little numbers with a plus between them. What Tolman points out is that there is often more structure just beneath that plus. Some of those little numbers may stand for premises that function as what he calls data. Some function instead as what he calls warrants. They function together, just like we've said, but function together in a specific way. Here's what I mean. Any argument starts with some kind of data. But an argument often doesn't just go from data to conclusion. It has a middle step. A step that says how that data is supposed to lead to the conclusion. So instead of just a plus between premises 1 and 2, it might be better to represent them like this. Here's an example. The CAT scan shows a shadow on the lungs. When there's that kind of shadow, cancer is a real possibility, and so further tests are in order. We should do a biopsy. The data in this case? The fact that the CAT scan shows a shadow on the lungs. The conclusion? That we should do a biopsy. The warrant is the general principle that takes us from the data to the conclusion. It's not so much an additional piece of information as an inference ticket. Given this data, we should draw this conclusion. In this case, the warrant is, when there's that kind of shadow, cancer is a real possibility, and so further tests are in order. Here's another example. You tell me what the conclusion is, what's playing the role of data, and what's acting as warrant. He can't be guilty of first-degree murder. The defendant was heavily intoxicated at the time and acted in the heat of emotion. First-degree murder demands premeditation. Press pause and think about it for a minute if you want to. The data? The claim that the defendant was intoxicated at the time and acted in the heat of emotion. The conclusion that he can't be guilty of first-degree murder. What's the warrant? What greases the track from data to conclusion? The principle that first-degree murder demands premeditation. Data, emotion, and intoxication at the time. Warrant, first-degree demands premeditation. Conclusion, he can't be guilty of first-degree murder. There are, of course, very different kinds of arguments. Scientific arguments, legal arguments, ethical arguments. It's important to note that very different kinds of warrants are appropriate for those different kinds of arguments. For some arguments, in scientific contexts, for example, it's a probability warrant that's appropriate. 90% of the experiments showed a latency effect. That's strong inductive or empirical support. Sometimes the argument's over the use of a term. In that case, the warrant may be a definition. Whales breathe air and give live birth, so they're mammals. Sometimes it's a legal principle that serves as warrant. The contract wasn't signed, it's therefore unenforceable. The warrant? A legal principle that unsigned contracts aren't enforceable. Sometimes it's an ethical rule that serves as warrant. It was deliberately deceitful, so what he did was wrong. Here, the warrant is our belief that deception is unethical. Graphing arguments in terms of data and warrant can help in analyzing both individual arguments and the structure of debates. We all know that there are often two sides to an issue. The distinction between data and warrant lets us see that there are two different ways those different sides may be in conflict. Sometimes what's at issue in a controversy is disagreement about the data. Any argument will go from data to conclusion. If one side doesn't recognize the other side's starting point as genuine data, there's going to be no meeting of the minds. That's a problem in disputes regarding abortion. Opponents of legalized abortion may start the argument with, "A fetus is a person." Precisely because that claim is not accepted as genuine data by the opposition, the argument won't convince the other side. Proponents of legalized abortion, on the other hand, may start the argument with, "A woman's rights regarding her own body are absolute." Precisely because that is not accepted as data on the other side, their argument fails to convince the other side as well. But controversies often continue even when both sides do agree on the data. Why? Because the two sides don't agree on what the data warrants. Controversies regarding gun control seem to be like this. The statistics on gun ownership, crime, and accidents in the home may be conceded on both sides. Both sides may agree that there is a right to self-defense. They may even agree on what the Second Amendment says. But one side thinks that the statistics warrant restrictions on gun ownership despite individual rights. The other side thinks that individual rights trump the social statistics, that the statistics alone are insufficient warrant for further restriction. When you graph that controversy in terms of data and warrant, it's clear that the core dispute is over the prioritization of values, individual rights versus the prevention of harm. The two sides may agree on the data, but emphasis on different background principles takes them from that same data to different conclusions. In that case, you have a dispute over warrant. The next time you find yourself in apparent controversy with someone, ask whether you disagree about the data or the warrant. That may help to keep people from talking past each other. Graphing logical flow can only take you so far, of course. It can't alone resolve disputes like this, but it can help in deciding where the dispute really lies. Here's what I want you to take home from this lecture. Rational argument is a matter of logical flow. To understand an argument is to be able to see that logical flow, to see lines of argument that branch to multiple conclusions, to see how different reasons may work independently to support a conclusion, or to see how they may have to work dependently together. If we can sketch out the logical flow, we have a better grasp on validity, on how strong the reasons offered really are for the conclusion. We can also identify stress points of vulnerability. Analysis in terms of data and warrant offers a further fine-tuning of the graphing approach, particularly useful in analyzing what's really in dispute in long-standing controversies. In the next lecture, we'll move to aspects of our reasoning that don't need graphing, aspects of reasoning that are quick and dirty, but often very effective. We'll be talking about conceptual heuristics that make us smart. Welcome back. This is a lecture on heuristics. A heuristic is a rule of thumb, like you should always have 3 to 6 months' pay in the bank in case of emergency, or to approximate a 15% tip, double the sales tax. Heuristics are guides to actions that are simpler and cruder than a complete calculation or a logical examination of all the possibilities. Simpler, cruder, and faster. Albert Einstein published a paper in 1905 entitled On a Heuristic Point of View Concerning the Generation and Transformation of Light. He used that title to indicate that the approach in the paper was sketchy and incomplete, maybe even false by the lights of a complete theory, but useful nonetheless. That's what heuristics are like. In this lecture, I want to introduce you to heuristics that can be simpler, cruder, faster, and just as good or even better than a complete rational calculation. Some of these heuristics seem to generate knowledge from ignorance in an almost magical way. In the phrase used by Gerd Gigerenzer, the German psychologist who did much of the background research, these are simple heuristics that make us smart. Simple heuristics also come with a warning label, however. While they're often useful, they're not guaranteed. Calculating a 15% tip by doubling the sales tax only works if the tax rate is 7.5%. Let's start with a simple but obscure question. Which city has a larger population, San Diego or San Antonio? That question was posed to two groups of students, to students at the University of Chicago and to students at the University of Munich. Who do you think did better? The University of Chicago students are a smart bunch, and of course, they're American. 62% of them got the answer right. San Diego has the larger population. What about the Germans? This may surprise you. 100% of the German students got the question right. All of them said that San Diego was larger. How could that be? Are the German students better informed about American demographics than University of Chicago students? No, in fact, they generally know significantly less about American cities and their population. 100% of the German students got the answer right, despite the fact that they know less about American cities. In fact, they got the answer right precisely because they know less. The German students seem to have used this heuristic, this rule of thumb. I've certainly heard of San Diego. I'm not sure I've heard of San Antonio. That must be because San Diego is a more prominent city. That probably means it's larger. Which has the larger population? I'll go with San Diego. This is a recognition heuristic. In general, you're asked about the value of two objects, whatever value, size of population, number of department stores, tax revenues, it doesn't matter. If you recognize one of them and not the other, pick the one you recognize as having the higher value. The German students could use that heuristic because they had a significantly clearer recognition of the one city than the other. They used their ignorance to good effect. The Chicago students didn't have that advantage. They didn't have that valuable ignorance. They were familiar with both San Diego and San Antonio, and so perhaps had to fall back on thinking of the position of the cities on a map, or San Diego is near the ocean and probably crowded with suburbs. San Antonio has lots of space. Things in Texas are always bigger. That's why only 62% of the Chicago students ended up with the right answer. Recognition is a fast and frugal heuristic. It's frugal because it works with extremely limited information. In fact, it demands that your information be extremely limited. Let's try you on the recognition heuristic. So here are two German cities. Which do you think has the larger population? Munich? Berlin? Do you have that? If you said Berlin is larger, perhaps because it's more familiar, you're right. The more detailed we get, the riskier it is. But let me try you on one more. Here are five German cities. How would you rank them in terms of population? Stuttgart? Bremen? Cologne? Berlin? Munich? If you're like me, you don't really know anything about relative population sizes. But if we list them in terms of recognition, they might go like this: Berlin, Munich, Cologne, Stuttgart, Bremen. That is, in fact, their order in terms of population size. Of course, this rule of thumb also has important limitations. Will it always work? No. A recognition heuristic works only when there is a real correlation behind it. A correlation between familiarity and population size, for example. When you don't have any further information, that correlation can sometimes be a good bet. It's interesting that it demands limited knowledge of the topic in order for this to work. If you know too much, you can't use it. So suppose you have three groups of people. One's extremely knowledgeable about the issue. One knows about half that much. One group is totally ignorant. For some questions, because of the recognition heuristic, it's the middle group that'll do the best. Those who know absolutely nothing can't use it. They don't recognize any of the alternatives. Those who know too much can't use it. They recognize them all. It's those in the middle who recognize some but not all of the alternatives who can put the heuristic to work effectively. The group that ran the experiment with German and American students put the results to the test by gauging success on the stock market. They made a list of companies from the New York Stock Exchange and from several German exchanges. They asked four groups of people to indicate which stocks they recognized. The four groups: American experts on the stock market, German experts, American lay people — they actually used pedestrians off the street — and German lay people. They asked each group, which of these companies do you recognize? German lay people recognized German companies like Allianz AG, Daimler-Benz, and Siemens, for example. U.S. lay people recognized U.S. companies like Amoco, Chrysler, Maytag, Sears Roebuck. Both groups recognized Lufthansa. Experts on each side, of course, recognized more. The experimenters then put together mock portfolios of the stocks recognized by over 90% of each group. They made a portfolio of the German stocks that German lay people recognized, a portfolio of German stocks that German experts recognized, similarly for Americans and American stocks. They also made a portfolio of American stocks that German lay people recognized, and one of American stocks that German experts recognized, and similarly for Americans. So, eight different pretend stock portfolios. They then tracked how well each did compared with the market index and mutual funds. Could it actually be possible that mere recognition beats the stock market index? When it comes to bets across borders, the answer is yes. Take the recognition portfolio of American lay people on German stocks. That did better than both mutual funds and the market index. It even did a little better than the portfolio of German stocks based on recognition by American experts. Returns for German lay people and German experts on American stocks did better than either the market index or mutual funds. When the bets were on stocks within countries, the results were mixed. German laypeople and German experts still did better by recognition alone. American laypeople and American experts betting on American stocks didn't. That was the only area in which the recognition heuristic lost. Maybe Americans weren't ignorant enough to use it. Maybe they knew too much. The portfolios constructed of stocks recognized by experts didn't do particularly well. That doesn't mean they didn't know their stuff. It's natural that the experts will recognize more stocks, both good and bad. But there are plenty of cases in which the experts do turn out to be wrong. Harry Warner was one of the founding brothers of Warner Brothers. But in 1927, just as movies changed from silent to sound, he predicted that movies with sound would be a flop. Who the hell wants to hear actors talk? In 1943, Thomas Watson, the father of IBM, said, "I think there's a world market for maybe 5 computers." Niels Bohr defined an expert as a man who has made all the mistakes which can be made in a very narrow field. Carl Sandburg characterized an expert as a damn fool a long way from home. What we need to be able to do is to tell the real experts, those who actually know, from the so-called experts. The suspicion is that many so-called experts may not, in fact, be particularly knowledgeable. Real experts are going to be those who really do know, but it may be hard to pick those out. This next heuristic indicates that you may not need to know who the real experts are. This is the rule of thumb known as the wisdom of crowds. Sir Francis Galton was a distinguished British scientist. He also happened to be a cousin of Charles Darwin. Galton is remembered positively for his studies of heredity and intelligence. He's remembered negatively for founding eugenics. Galton was convinced that some people are inherently smarter than others. He thought we should breed the smart ones and prevent reproduction by the dumb ones. He considered the intelligence of the general public to be deplorable. That fact about Galton makes this next case particularly interesting. In the fall of 1906, the 85-year-old Galton attended the annual West of England Fat Stock and Poultry Exhibition. They had a weight judging competition. A prize ox was put on display, and people put wagers on how much the ox weighed, or more precisely, how much it would weigh after it had been butchered and dressed. You bought a ticket for 6 pence, and you wrote down your estimate. There was a prize for the person whose guess was the closest. 800 people entered the competition, all kinds of people. There were farmers and butchers who you might expect to know this kind of thing. Those were the experts. But there were also all kinds of rabble and riffraff. With the attitude of a typical aristocratic snob, Galton said, quote, "The average competitor was probably as well fitted for making a just estimate of the dressed weight of the ox as an average voter is of judging the merits of most political issues on which he votes." Because of his interest in statistics and because of his prejudices regarding intelligence, Galton decided to conduct a little experiment. When the contest was over, he asked for all the tickets that had been submitted. There were exactly 800 tickets, but 13 were illegible. Galton cut the sample down to the remaining 787. He laid them out in order of the guessed weight. He then took the median, the guess in the very middle, with half of the guesses greater, half of the guesses less. The median guess was 1,207 pounds. The actual weight of the ox, when butchered and dressed, was 1,198 pounds. That's an error of less than 1%. The result hit Galton's anti-democratic, aristocratic, eugenic-prone beliefs pretty hard. He said, "The result seems more creditable to the trustworthiness of a democratic judgment than might have been expected." Galton reported the median of the guesses, the point at which there were as many above as there were below. But he saved all the data, and from that we can figure out something even simpler, the mean, the simple average. And that result's even more amazing. The real weight of the ox, when butchered and dressed, was 1,198 pounds. The average of the guesses for the weight of the ox, the average guess of the assorted rabble, with all those non-experts, was 1,197 pounds. That's an error of less than 0.1%. What's the heuristic here? In this case, it's social. When in doubt, go with the mean judgment. When in doubt, rely on the wisdom of crowds. Here's another case along those lines. Remember Regis Philbin and Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? The idea of that show was that people were asked multiple choice questions that got progressively more difficult. If you answered 15 questions in a row, you got $1 million. If a contestant didn't know the answer to a question, they could do one of three things. They could have two of the four options removed, increasing the odds of guessing right. They could call a friend whom they had singled out in advance as one of the smartest people they knew. That's our expert. The third option was to ask the studio audience, with a majority answer polled immediately and electronically. So how well did the experts do in Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? How often did they choose the right answer? They actually did pretty well. The experts picked the correct answer 65% of the time. How well did the studio audience do? They picked the correct answer 91% of the time. Those two examples come from James Surowiecki, a business columnist for The New Yorker. It's not technically the mean, though it is the majority vote. When in doubt, rely on the wisdom of crowds. There are more than just stories behind this heuristic, however. The wisdom of crowds has a simple statistical explanation. The explanation shows why it works, when it works, and when you shouldn't expect it to work. So suppose you're a contestant on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and you get this question. Which river did Caesar cross? A, the Amazon. B, the Danube. C, the Mississippi. D, the Rubicon. You have no idea of the answer. You could call your expert. The experts were right 65% of the time. Or you can ask for a poll of the studio audience. The audience was right 91% of the time. How can that be? The audience contains all kinds of people, many of whom have totally distorted ideas of who Caesar even was. Many of them are as ignorant as you are. How can a majority vote of that rabble be accurate 91% of the time? Here's how. The audience probably does contain at least a few people who do know the answer. I'll simplify this by taking this to extremes. Suppose that the audience had just two kinds of people. One, people who know the answer, and two, those who are totally ignorant. Take the people who know the answer. They'll pick D, the Rubicon. Now take those who are totally ignorant. If they're totally ignorant, their answers will spread randomly across all four alternatives. That's going to be the key. So let's start by tallying the answers of the ignorant. Those will spread randomly across all four alternatives. Then add the answers from the people who know. Take that answer that got the most votes. What is it? The Rubicon. The statistical phenomenon behind the wisdom of crowds is the fact that the ignorant answers randomize over all possibilities. When we go for the answer that got the most votes, the ignorant answers effectively cancel each other out. That leaves the knowledgeable answers to tip the scale. In that simplification, I assumed that people divided neatly between the ignorant and the knowledgeable. But the explanation stands even if we don't assume that. Suppose that there are people who are more or less knowledgeable, and people who are more or less ignorant. Those who are more or less knowledgeable will hit the right answer more or less. Those who are more or less ignorant will guess randomly, more or less, and the effect will be the same. The wisdom of crowds will reflect the degree of wisdom of even a few people in the crowd. That same explanation holds for Galton's ox. There were some people in that crowd who really did know how to estimate the weight of an ox. The rest of the people didn't. But precisely because they didn't, they were as likely to guess too high as to guess too low. When you line up the answers from low to high, the answers of those who really know will end up approximately in the middle. The highs and lows will cancel each other out. That's Galton's median. When you average all the answers, the random highs and lows cancel out, allowing the more knowledgeable answers to shine through. So, statistics explain the effect. They also show when you can rely on it and when you'd better not. Here are the conditions. In order for this to work, you have to have an audience in which there are some people who really do know the answer. A crowd of school children won't outguess Warren Buffett on stock choices. But it's interesting that you don't have to know who the people are who really know. You don't have to be able to identify the experts. All you have to know is that there are some people in that crowd who really do know. The other condition is that the wrong answers have to really be random. It won't work if all the ignorant people have the same kind of ignorance. It won't work if they all think that Mississippi is going to be the answer to all questions about rivers, for example, just because it's hard to spell. Lots of people with lots of different biases is fine. Those are the biases that'll cancel each other out. What you don't want is to have all the biases in the same direction. Let's move on to another heuristic, important not for picking answers, but for deciding what to do. In decision-making, the ideally rational setup is one in which you examine all courses of action, calculate consequences, compare benefits and losses, and then decide. If you're making an important decision and you have the time, that's what you should do. But the demands of action often preclude that kind of extended consideration. Often the alternatives are too many, and the demands are too immediate. If you're a fireman deciding how to fight a basement fire, you don't have time to be a perfect maximizer. You don't have time to look up the blueprints, map out all possible ways of entry, analyze the probabilities that certain fire-retardant materials were used in construction, access medical records in order to determine the probability that a child on the third floor is asthmatic. The fireman doesn't have time for all that. Lives are at risk, and property's going up fast. We often don't have time to be perfect maximizers. The heuristic to use in these kinds of cases is called satisficing. Pick a realistic set of goals. The fireman's may be these: keep your comrades safe, get everyone out of the building, put the fire out before it spreads to the next building. Now, start looking for a course of action that will achieve those goals, any course of action. Consider alternatives in any order they happen to occur to you. You're not looking for perfection. You're looking for good enough. You're trying to be a satisficer. So the heuristic here, take that first course of action that meets your goals. Go! There's evidence that satisficing is in fact the way firefighters think. There's also biological evidence that it's built into a wide range of animal behavior. Believe it or not, satisficing is often used in computer programs as well. Even computers don't have time to consider all the options in every case. Heuristics are rational shortcuts. Given the selective pressure imposed by the environment, it's not surprising that animals should have some heuristic shortcuts built in. The animal has to do something to shake off the predator and has to do it now. If there's a way of doing that, without all the time delay of careful logical calculation, evolution will select for it. Those organisms that have the technique built in will live to reproduce more consistently. So the result is a behavioral heuristic built into the species. We can expect generally successful heuristics to be chosen for, even if they don't work all the time. Quick and dirty techniques that evade predators, much of the time, will be selected for, too. People have an evolutionary history. When we look at ourselves, we can expect to find some generally useful heuristics built in. In an earlier lecture, we looked at gut reactions and emotions in this light. Those are part of our behavioral inheritance. Fear is a heuristic for getting out of the way. Disgust is a heuristic for avoidance. The emotions involved in sexual attraction, on the other hand, are telling you something more positive. So, should you try to calculate things rationally, or should you go with your gut? The answer seems to be both. Neither emotions nor gut reactions should be ignored. They have the experience of our ancestors built in. When a decision is of the same type as those made by our ancestors, and it has to be made fast, like getting out of the way of an approaching stampede, extended calculation is clearly a bad idea. Go with your gut. On the other hand, our rationality is also a major part of our evolutionary inheritance. If it hadn't been good for anything, we wouldn't have it. Rational calculation is going to be particularly useful where a decision is long range, where it doesn't have to be made immediately. In that case, we should use all of our resources, survey all available information, and weigh all options carefully. To rely on gut reactions and emotions alone might well be to make the wrong decision. Rational deliberation is also going to be particularly important when the decisions we face are not the same as those faced by our ancestors. Evolution hasn't had time to catch up with the need to make presentations before one's business partners, for example. It hasn't had time to catch up with the internet and cell phones. Business partners aren't as hazardous as predators. They won't literally eat you. If your system is recruiting a heuristic appropriate to predators, then it's recruiting the wrong heuristic. Rationality should override it. Cell phones and internet access are not as important as the food you need for tomorrow. If your system reacts to losing them as if it were a matter of literal survival, it's recruiting the wrong heuristic. Rationality should override. Not all heuristics are built in. Some can be deliberately acquired. Here's a lesson on acquired heuristics from one of the great thinkers, Neumann Janos. I put him near the top of my list of the smartest people of the 20th century. Born in Hungary in 1903, he changed his name to John von Neumann by the time he came to America. He made major advances in set theory, in number theory, and in computer science. He basically invented game theory, which we'll talk about later. He was a major mover in the Manhattan Project, responsible for the atomic bomb in World War II. In the later hydrogen bomb, and in the early years of the Atomic Energy Commission. Along with Einstein, he was one of the original members of the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton. And all of our computers embody what's known as the von Neumann architecture. The interesting thing about von Neumann is that he quite deliberately built his own kit of heuristics. It was that kit of heuristics that let him cross fields so easily and productively, from physics and mathematics to economics to game theory. I'm sure you've seen technical textbooks with lists of formulae in the back, always a little forbidding. We go to them only when we have to. Not von Neumann. Those were von Neumann's favorite part. He would deliberately memorize the formulae in the back of textbooks, formulae in matrix arithmetic, formulae in physics, formulae in theoretical biology, formulae in economics. Why? So that he could use those patterns as heuristics. In particular, so that he could recognize similar patterns elsewhere. In the history of ideas, it's repeatedly happened that an idea in one area developed for one purpose finds an unexpected application elsewhere. Concepts developed purely for philosophy of mathematics turned out to be just what you needed to build a computer. Statistical formulae developed for understanding genetic change in biology are now applied in both economics and in programming. Von Neumann's strategy was to familiarize himself with those formal patterns in